Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hey, everybody, it's Adam Ray for the About Last Night podcast. Happy belated 4th of July. Happy birthday, America. Oh, yeah. Hope you guys had a safe and happy 4th. I was in Lake Tahoe at the Improv up there. Saw some fireworks, did some shows, had a great time, went on a boat. Saw a guy win $38,000 at blackjack on ecstasy. It was fucking amazing. Back in Los Angeles, getting ready for some shows. I will be at the Punchline in San Francisco, July 23rd through the 26th. I will also be, where also will I be? I'll be at the Irvine Improv, July 15th. I'll be at the Ice House, July 11th and July 12th. And the Comedy Store and the Laugh Factory during the week. Check AdamRayTV.com for all the tour dates. Follow me on Twitter at Adam Ray Comedy. Of course, pick up my album Pop-Tart Suicide on my website. And if you're going to go see Brad Williams live, check out his dates at bradwilliamscomedy.com. July 10th through the 13th, he's at the Comedy Works South in Denver, Colorado. July 17th through the 19th at Hyenas in Fort Worth, Texas. And the 24th of July through the 27th in Kansas City at the Improv. Go to bradwilliamscomedy.com to get your tickets and follow Brad at FunnyBrad on Twitter. Of course, Brad has just returned from Brazil. He made it safe and sound. I got to be honest. I really fucking thought he was not going to come back. There was a piece of me that legitimately thought that was going to be it. But thank God he's back. He's got stories. He even grew a couple inches, I think. We'll find out whether that was, from head to toe or from ball to dick. Excited to get back with my buddy and do a Brad and Adam podcast, which will be coming out very soon. And we'll rehash the last couple weeks of all the fun we've had to share with you guys. Of course, rate and subscribe the podcast on iTunes. Give us a 5-star rating. It helps bump the podcast up the charts. We got a lot of great guests coming up. Jay Moore, Adam Carolla, Nick Swartzen, Melissa McCarthy, John Stamos, Theo Vaughn, Tom Arnold. Really pumped about the shows we got coming up. And of course, if you have your own show or even a business that you're trying to get off the ground, visit our friends at MyMetalBusinessCard.com. Why? Because they're the best in the biz at what they do. All right? They set out to do one thing. Make your life better with the highest quality business cards on the planet. And they do them with custom metal business cards. You can get stainless steel cards, copper finish cards, bottle opener cards, brass finish cards, or straight up black metal cards. Yeah, you know where you can get it? MyMetalBusinessCard.com, motherfucker. Because these players do it right, okay? They've got the best in the biz of all the business cards. If you want a business card, stop using those flimsy, floppy, fucking paper mache origami bullshit, all right? It's not what people use anymore. It's going to get lost in your fucking wallet. It's going to get stuck to the condom you took off that you didn't want to throw away in the girl's place. It's not the way people do business anymore. So go to MyMetalBusinessCard.com. Tell them the About Last Night podcast sent you and they'll hook you up. MyMetalBusinessCard.com. That's all the information. That's what we got. And by the way, today's episode is a fucking doozy, man. Barry Katz is the guest on the podcast. He's one of the biggest managers in Hollywood. A few of his clients he's repped. I don't know, Dane Cook, Dave Chappelle, Whitney Cummings, Tracy Morgan, Louis C.K., Jay Moore. The list goes on and on. Barry took time to sit down with Brad and I and have a talk about the business. He's got amazing stories from starting a comedy club in Boston to seeing Dave Chappelle for the first time at 14 to going on tour with Dane Cook and selling out arenas. And then he gives Brad and I a little advice for the road as we continue on our journey in this crazy business called Hollywood. And just a heads up, this episode ends a little abruptly as Barry gets into starting to give me some advice on capitalizing more on my audition. auditions for TV and movies, the episode cuts off. And that is because we've got a part two with Barry coming out in a few weeks. We had so much to talk about. It literally, there was not enough time. And an hour and a half, I felt like, was a good beginning way to wet the palate, to stroke you a little bit before you come Barry Katz's excitement. Jesus. So we will have a part two to this episode. So just beware that it will cut off when Barry asks me a question, and then I start to think about how to respond, and oh man, that's where we leave you hanging. It's a great episode. Barry's a swell dude. He's like 6'5". Everyone has an impersonation of him. He's a class act. He's a great guy. He knows the business, and he came by and brought it, and you're going to love it. So sit back, relax, and listen to this very, very special episode of the About Last Night podcast with Mr. Barry Katz.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. Got a midget and a Jew, so why don't you sit down and listen to a no podcast during lunch, dinner, or breakfast. Brad Williams and Adam Ray are here for you any time of the day. So come on and treat yourself right. It's about last night.
We're here in the 28th floor in Hollywood with the most incredible view in an office I've ever seen.
This is amazing.
In the office of the great manager, Barry Katz.
All right, I made the cut.
Made the cut, and now you're on the world famous About Last Night podcast. You're following in the footsteps of many of your clients. In fact,
it's fascinating. I can't believe it. Even you know, I feel like I get to you know, Chris D'Elia gets to open for me.
I mean, it's pretty great. Yeah, Chris D'Elia, Bob Saget,
and if for any reason you're our listener and you don't know Barry Katz, first of all, he has a great podcast which we'll get into called Industry Standard with Barry Katz. It gives a fascinating insight into this crazy profession that we've decided to get into. But if you don't know Barry, you definitely know people that you've managed. The client list is incredible. Dave Chappelle, Jim Brewer, Dane Cook, Nick Swartzen, Whitney Cummings, Jay Moore, Tracy Morgan, Louis C.K. Now, these are all people that you've managed.
A bunch of hacks. these are all brilliant people.
Now, how come there's no Ted Danson, Marshall Warfield on that list?
Rita Rudner.
I don't know why there's none of those. Probably because I was 7 when they were starting.
Yeah. Well, listen, start them young, Barry. I don't know what took you so long.
There used to be a joke, because I always used to represent, a lot of people don't know this about me, but I started as a stand-up comedian in Boston.
Is that when you started the club?
I started doing comedy. Do you want to hear this story?
Absolutely.
By the way, Barry is known for, do you want to hear this story? And then telling 90-minute stories that are great. Yeah. They have like punchlines and have beginnings and middles and endings. There's like stories inside of stories. It's like Inception anytime Barry talks.
Listen,
but it's a great dream.
My son had oatmeal this morning. Do you want to hear the story? It's fascinating.
Yeah. And you're like, no, I don't want to hear about your son having oatmeal.
But somehow that story gets into how Nick Swartzen booked his first stand-up special.
Right, exactly.
That's crazy. Yeah. I never heard you do an impression of me.
You haven't heard the Brand Williams Barry Katz?
It's pretty good.
It's pretty good. Now, don't get me wrong, it's not my Shakira impression.
Yeah.
Which is legendary.
Do you find it flattering that people have impressions of you? Because like, there's a few comic buddies who in the last week have done impressions of me to me, and they're terrible. And I don't get offended. I just am like, I want to be like, but make it good, because they go, hey, I'm Adam Ray, and I'm like, all right, my mom does that. Like that's so like that's not anything new to me. But like when people first start impersonating you, I feel like that's a flatter. Like people impersonate Dean Del Rey, but that's because he's got that cartoony voice. Like, oh, Barry, dude, you were on Let There Be Talk, and dude, I didn't give you the light because you're a legend. So it's like everyone. That's a great voice.
As he
to
gives you a flyer to his next show.
Oh, come on, I'll be at Terrifying Improv tonight. Actually, it already happened. But here's the DVD.
I'll retweet you.
Yeah, but like Dean has a great voice worth impersonating. I think that's why it gets done. Also because he's a character in himself.
Sure.
But with your voice, and we'll get to the story that you're going to tell. But do you enjoy hearing all the cat's impressions?
I do. I mean, I've always loved the art of roasting and people shitting on people, and people have imitated my voice since I was a little kid. And I just,
oh, for real?
Yeah, and it sounded like this when I was a little kid too.
Just as deep.
So you were like in third grade going, listen, man, if you represent our team on the kickball field, give me 10% of your juice boxes. I'll just need 10%. You get to call me coach. I get a coach credit at the end of the season, but I'll put this team together, man.
That is an actual recording of me on the kickball field, yes.
Do the East – okay, so tell the story. I was going to ask the shitting on people in the East Coast thing, I've always heard is a very New York, Boston-y thing amongst comics, right?
Well, it's weird. Like, when I was growing up, and I will tell that other story, I had, like
Jesus, just trying to put some music to this story.
Incredible the way you're – is that music that you wrote, or
– I don't know what's happening. Okay, there we go.
Mm-hmm. That's the edit point.
Yes. Absolutely.
No, I had, like, really – I sucked my thumb until I was, like, 13. I had, like
– well, you were doing it when we walked in here, so I was going to say –
yeah,
like,
I don't know if you'd truly gotten over it.
I don't think that's a habit.
I had, like – not that I don't have huge teeth now. As Jay Moore says, I could eat an apple through a white picket fence with the way my teeth are. But I had huge buck teeth. Wow. I wore braces for 6 years.
Wow.
And all through school, I was like, you know, you don't really make friends when you have teeth the size of Mr. Ed, you know what I'm saying, with braces around.
What do they call you? Because I was a fat kid, and I got some pretty nicknames that I look back on that I'm like, that's, like, incredible that you would think of that as a kid. Because usually it's, you're like, I'm sure you got, hey, big teeth, or
I didn't get shit on as much because I had two friends that were really, really, I don't know why they befriended me, but I had two guys who were, like, the most popular guys, but they loved hanging out with me because I was funny, and I was always entertaining, and they would love having me around. So I spared the wrath of, but I you know, later on, I didn't go to my prom. I didn't get any action. I wasn't one of those guys who was, like, making it happen like Brad Williams. I mean, my God, this guy, I've never seen any, if I could just have, like, a fraction of the women that this guy has, it's just insanity. Yeah. I've never.
You'd have a full eight women.
Yeah, yeah. Wait, are you saying if you want a fraction of the dwarf women he gets, or of the real?
I think
normal?
He does. Yeah. I've had various meetings with Barry. He's like, Bran, how does it work? I gotta know, man.
Who's on top of who?
Who's on top of who? Does everything line up accordingly?
I just think to myself, when I'm naked and I look in the mirror out of the shower and I look at what's there in the area, in the central area.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when I think to myself, this would look monstrous on Brad Williams.
I was waiting to hear another dwarf name, but I didn't know you were criticizing about Bradley.
You know what? And that's the kind of manager you are. Even when you're naked, you are still thinking about your clients. I'm liking that. I'm loving that
incredible
about you, Barry.
Yeah, yeah.
this podcast is going nowhere
this
fast.
This is great. No, this is this is how we do it. All right, so.
You're starting comedy in Boston.
Yeah, you started.
Yeah, so
doing stand-up.
I'm sorry. So I started doing stand up. What happened was that my father passed away when I was four, and I explored in my basement. I pried open a file cabinet, and I grew up in an all white area, Longmeadow, Massachusetts, which is an Indian word. It means Jews live here. And I had all these albums, and
that
they were all
true to me. Yeah, I don't know if that was a joke or not.
Well, that's for you to decide. And there were all these black albums of, like, Dinah Washington and Louis Armstrong and Nat King Cole and the Supremes and Shirley Bassey. And there were three albums in there that were from white artists, and they were all comedy records. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Winters, Comedy and Tragedy.
Genius.
The Smothers Brothers right there.
Oh, there you go.
It was Crabs Walk Sideways and Lobsters Walk Straight. And there was The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart.
Oh, wow.
And later on in my career, for those in your audience who don't know this, Bob Newhart was a guy who did, you know, bits on television, Bob Hope specials, things
Bob
like
Newhart
that.
Bob Newhart show was legendary.
Like, and Bob Bob Newhart special and also the show later was legendary. But early on, Warner Brothers called him and they said, hey, we want you to do a comedy record. Mm-hmm. And in his stutter step way, he said, I don't know how to tell you this, but I'm not a comic. I just do sketches and things. They said, it doesn't matter. We'll just send a recording crew wherever you want to do it, record it, do an album. That was Warner Brothers Records' first stand-up record.
Okay.
And in 1959, it was Warner Brothers Records' first gold record, was a comedy record.
Holy wow.
Shit.
Nice little bit of
that,
trivia.
So I memorized all these bits from there. I memorized a famous routine from there. Called The Driving Instructor. And for those of you who are in comedy, and I recommend very few things, but back then, when you listen to comedy, you know, like you go to a show right now, like if Brad or Adam were to do a show, and you were to see them get the kind of response that, let's say, like Bob Newhart got, or Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks doing The 2,000-Year-Old Man, you would think they were bombing. Because back then, people were doing humor where people, they watched comedy like sort of you watch a television show and you're just going...
Enjoy it.
Yeah, that's nice. That's good.
Wow.
And so Bob's...
How would they gauge if they were, I mean, great or not?
Well, in the Borscht Belt, Hackett used to tell me, Buddy Hackett, by the way, who was a very good friend of mine, and he was an actor on the first show I ever executive produced, Action. And I got to know him very, very well. I'm digressing with the stories. Nope. Mm-hmm. But just to tell you, you know, one of the things you learn in your life is how much you might have meant to somebody when you don't really understand it. And as you get older and you lose people in your life, you find the answers to these things. And when Buddy Hackett passed away, I got the call from his wife. And she said, will you come over? And I came over the house, and I go into the house, and it's me and his wife. And there's nobody else there. And I'm thinking, holy shit. And then the doorbell rings, and she said, will you get that for me? I open the door. It's Jeffrey Ross.
Mm-hmm.
And then about an hour later, the doorbell rings a final time, and I open the door, and it's Jay Moore. And it was the three of us with Sherry Hackett talking till 3 o'clock in the morning. And then one of her children came and the night he died. And so he meant a lot to me. And to digress, I'm sorry, but in Vegas, he was making $175,000 a week in 1951.
That's pretty solid.
And back then, Buddy Hackett in the live shows would kill. I mean, he'd just kill. He was in another level. He did the first two HBO specials. But the kind of comedy that Bob Newhart did was very cerebral, and he did the kind of comedy, for those of you who are comedy aficionados, the only thing that compares to it is one bit that Ellen did on The Tonight Show about 20 years ago called Conversations with God.
Yeah.
I strongly suggest you go on YouTube and look it up. It's an amazing bit. And Bob Newhart did this kind of humor where he painted a picture, sort of like Vin Scully for the Dodgers and Major League Baseball paints a picture for those of you on radio, where he tells you and he does the dialogue of everything that's happening. And I actually... I hope I can remember the first 30 seconds of this piece, because I memorized and I performed it for a talent show, and I'll show you the kind of humor it was, because it wasn't gut-busting humor, but how he did it. And he would do it like this. He would say, there's a group of men who go to work every day, and they don't know if they're going to come home at night. And I'm talking about America's driving instructors. So picture a car.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the driving instructor, and seated next to me is a woman driver. Now, back then, a woman driver was the equivalent to what I guess we'd shit on somebody who was an older Chinese driver or something like that. And then he would start, and he would say, okay, let me sit down here. Your name is Mrs. Webb, is that correct? Yeah. Just let me read down here and familiarize myself with the case. Your instructor was Mr. Adams, is that correct? Yeah. How fast were you going when Mr. Adams jumped from the car? Oh, 75. Mm-hmm. And where was that, Mrs. Webb? In your driveway. And that was like how it went. That's how he did the bit. And he would do a 7-minute bit like that. But the laughs would be kind of like you are laughing. Nothing like, you know, you watch Def Jam. People are jumping out of their seats, high-fiving, doing a backflip into a tongue stand.
Right.
And you know, that's just when they see Cat Williams' suit.
That's right. So
is that because you think there's so much milking of the timing and the pauses that like people really don't want to miss anything, so they're so concerned with not concerned with laughing, but like listening so that they don't miss the next thing that's coming, because there's a lot of misdirection in a bit like that, right? So
I think so. He just had a different style. He was the closest thing, you know, if Stephen Wright doesn't get huge gut-busting laughs, right, but he takes the time and he brings you on a journey where you really have to think. And I definitely want to, I hope we get back to this, because I want to talk about the state of comedy in general and the kind of comedians that are out there, because I think
absolutely
it's really important.
As Jay Moore says, we will put a pin in that.
Yes.
And come back to it.
And so I figured out the routine. I memorized it. I did it at a high school talent show. And then I started doing it at open mic nights in Boston. And the first open mic night I went to, actually, it was a fluke, sort of, because there was a blizzard in Boston in 1978 where the whole town was shut down. And I'm in the middle of Kenmore Square. And if you've ever been to Boston, Kenmore Square is like the center where three major streets come off of it. Commonwealth Avenue to the right. The center is Beacon Street, which went off to Simmons College and Emmanuel. And then to the left, Brookline Avenue, where Fenway Park was.
Right.
And if I actually was standing in the middle, it's like midnight, blizzard. You know,
what do you do when there's a blizzard, by the way? I've been in Seattle snow, but nothing to where... Like everything is.
It was just an emergency where no cars were allowed on the road, and you stood there and you could look up three roads and there was nothing. And I'm looking, and it was one of the most surreal moments. And then something happened that was unbelievable. I heard laughter. And this was a defining moment.
And it was so quiet when you heard that, right?
Yeah, and it was a defining moment in my life, because I looked to my left and there was an old brownstone pub. And ironically, the name of the pub, Crossroads. And I walked up the stairs, and there was a young man on stage who looked like a young Larry from the Three Stooges, and he had a foot on a stool, and he was strumming a guitar, and there was about 30 people there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget this. He said, "Rachel, my dear, wish you were here. How I missed her." And he's strumming the guitar, and he says, "Having sex with Rachel was amazing." It was like a concert. Frisbees would be flying around the room. Beach balls would be hitting me in the head. And every time she wanted more, she'd light a match. Thank you. Good night. And he just walked down the stairs and into the night.
And disappeared. Yeah.
And that was the first comedian I ever saw. That was Stephen Wright.
I was just going to say
that was Stephen Wright.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow.
And so I
thought maybe there was no man even there, and that was the first time he did PCP. He hallucinated the whole thing. But
believe it or not, I've never really been a big drug user. The only time I was really majorly affected by drugs was when I did a development deal with Dave Chappelle, and he said, "Come on, man, you got to celebrate." And I had to leave for the airport that night and gather some stuff of Jay Moore's, because we were staying in the same place at the Academy Village Apartments in Magnolia, somewhere in North Hollywood. And I said, "Dave, I don't smoke. I'm sorry." "Barry, you got to smoke. We did
Barry,
this deal.
Come on, man."
And so I smoked this, apparently some kind of Dr. Dre chronic stuff. And I'm like, "Dave."
Which, by the way, how every black person figures white people describe weed is, "I had some Dr. Dre chronic stuff." It was I believe Snoop calls it the shizzle.
The shizzle.
I was Snoopy getting pebbles. High. I was getting high with Donald Sterling.
And,
yeah.
Oh.
No.
Yeah, this story.
So
yeah.
So I say, "Dave, nothing affects me. I can't. I'm too big. Yeah. Nothing's going to affect me."
Mm-hmm.
And I finished the joint with him, and he's like high. He's like, Dave was the kind of guy, literally, just to sidestep here for a second.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
For those of you who don't know this, you know, I work with Dave from when he was 18 to 26. And he was the kind of, and I hope, I think I can say this because it's common knowledge. I don't know what he does now, but back then, like, he was a guy who was like, he would literally wake up at the crack of noon, smoke a bag of weed a day, mm-hmm. and you'd meet up with him, and you wouldn't even be sure that he could function or what he'd be doing. And if we had a Letterman appearance or a Conan appearance, I'd be thinking, God, what's going to happen here? And the red light went on, and he was like magic. He was like a genius. I mean, it was unbelievable. The guy, Dave Chappelle, never fucking failed. It was unbelievable. He was like a brain surgeon. There wasn't one time where he ever failed that I know of when I was working with him. He did like 40 national television appearances in like, you know, the first 2 years.
What do you think it is about Dave as a performer, or what makes him so special that he was able to have something like that also going on with him and be able just to turn on and be, as you say, undeniable every time and not give an ounce of doubt to anyone watching that he isn't going to be incredible?
I don't, you know, I'm embarrassed to say that I don't know the answer to that, only that I know that there's people who come around once every 20 or 25 years, mm-hmm. which we're going to talk about, I promise, later.
It's all bullet pointed in my head. We're going to get through this.
So I promise. I'm going to go back to the story, though. So I sign up for the open mic night.
Stephen Wright walks out. Inspires you to just go.
Yeah, and I sign up for the open mic night there. I go back on the Monday. I've gotten back from the swimming championships. I've shaved my head. You know, I'm like, I as Steve Middleman says, I look like a giant thumb. But I'm cut up. I'm like, I got, you know, sure. I look a little different than I do now.
But this is the body you get to picture Brad Williams in front of.
Yeah.
That's right. That's what I do. I look in the mirror and I say, like, naked, I look like a bag of onions, but I'm thinking of Brad Williams.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I sign up. So I go to the thing and I'm in real, you know, swimmers are in great shape.
Yeah, phenomenal.
And
shape.
There's this guy hosting. His name's Ross Bickford. He was called the taxi driver, this huge 6'7" guy, and he's doing old jokes and things like that, and he goes to bring me up, and he does that thing like every comic has always experienced, this like this next guy, I don't know if he's funny or not, but he's hung like a buffalo, please welcome Barry Katz. And I'm like, and you're going up there for the first time, and you're like, oh my God, I gotta say something, like I was with him last night or some joke.
Right.
I made some joke, and then I went into the Bob Newhart routine, did the routine, said I'd like to do a Bob Newhart routine, and I did it, and it fucking killed, and it killed harder than the than the album. Mm-hmm. And I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. I feel great. And as you do when you're a comedian, when you do well, it fills the hole, and it's mm-hmm. wonderful until about an hour later, like mm-hmm. Chinese food, and you got to get something else, some other kind of fix. And I'm walking out, and the guy like runs after me. He says, Katz. I'm like, yeah, what's up, man? He said, listen, I got some advice for you. You're great. You had the best set of the night. I said, thank you so much. What's the advice? He said, listen, when you're doing somebody else's routine, don't mention their name. Just take the fucking bit.
Oh, my God.
And that's when I knew I had to start writing my own material.
Well, you had no idea at that point that was like something to not do, huh?
No, I had no
idea. Well, because no one does when they really get into the business. Yeah. I mean, when they just start. There's a million stories like that of guys going up and doing jokes that they thought – because they think, oh, it's a joke. Like when your friend tells you a joke on the playground or in the office, you go, oh, I can't wait to tell that joke to somebody else.
Yeah.
So then – like, and you don't know the rules until someone – punches you in the face and say, what the fuck are you doing telling my joke like that?
No, it's true.
So what was like the way you say like the Newhart routine was something that you would like memorize, and like were there other things that you maybe didn't perform that were like, for me, I would make people laugh when I was like in the fifth and sixth grade by memorizing Ace Ventura or anything Jim Carrey, and would do it on the back of the bus to all my friends. So like it seems like Newhart was that for you, but then you took it. But were there other things that you did?
No, because I wasn't. I was just goofy and funny with people, and it was just all improvisational. I never knew any bits or imitated anybody. It was right. It was a different time.
Mm-hmm. So then after the Newhart bit, then you're like, all right, I got to start writing.
Then I start writing. I write my own act, and then I do an open mic night. I sign up for one on a Wednesday night in Inman Square, Cambridge, at a place called the Ding Ho, which was a Chinese restaurant comedy club.
That was featured in the documentary When Stand Up Stood Out.
That's right.
The old Ding Ho.
The old documentary. I didn't do that documentary. I regret that till the day I die. I should have done that documentary.
A great doc on the Boston Comedy Studio.
That's not the comedy studio, is it?
No, it was Fran Salamita and his partner, I believe, who did it. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. And so I actually own the sign to the Ding Ho that I left in my building in Boston. I wonder if it's still there. So then I go there. Lenny Clark is hosting. For those of you who don't know Lenny Clark, he's an iconic Boston comedian.
He was on
Larroquette and Rescue Me and tons of stuff. He's an amazing natural
legend
talent.
In Boston.
Marty Olson used to play piano, who has created a bunch of children's shows, and he's just amazing. And you had great comedians, like local comedians like Don Gavin and DJ Hazard and Steve Sweeney. Steve Sweeney was a guy, just to let you know how powerful the Boston comedy scene was, and I don't care where you are in the country or the world listening to this. It's never happened anywhere. This guy would sell out three shows, 400 people each show on a Friday, 8, 10, and midnight every week. This is why these guys in Boston were amazing, but a lot of them didn't leave town because they were making so much money.
Right, yeah.
It was crazy.
And this was in the early 80s?
Yeah, it was in the 80s. And so I went to this open mic night. I do my original comedy. And I fucking kill again with my original comedy. I walk out, the same thing happens. Lenny Clark runs after me, and this is crazy. I'm getting scared. Again, it's not my first name. It's Katzy. Mm-hmm. Katzy. I'm like, what's up, Lenny? Thanks for putting me on. He's like, listen, where did you come from? I said, well, I go to Boston University. I just want to try it out. He said, listen, I want you to come back next week. I want you to open the show, and I want you to do the same thing. And I didn't know anything about comedy, and I looked at him and I said, listen, Lenny, I can't write 5 new minutes by next week. I'm sorry, I can't do it. And he paused and he looked at me, as they say, comedians say sometimes, he looked at me like the dog looks at the answering machine.
Right, right.
Yeah. And this is what he says to me, and this is when I knew, you know, I was in a new and different, harsher world. He looks at me and he says, you dumb Jew bastard. You stupid fucking kike. You motherfucking Jew. You come back here next week. You do the same act. Don't worry about it. I said, okay. Thank you.
And you thank someone, too.
Thank you for calling me a Heeb kike Jew bastard. And so I come back the next
week. Which coincidentally is your email, right? At AOL.com.
Yeah, right.
Heeb kike Jew bastard at Yahoo. Or I think you're still a Hotmail guy, or I don't know.
Yeah, all those young comics out there, send Barry an email this week. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. And so I go back, and I look around this Chinese restaurant / comedy club, mm-hmm. and it looks like the same neighborhood people. And I go up to Marty Olson and Lenny. I'm like, listen, guys, seems like the same people. Oh, don't worry about it, Barry. It's okay. Right. So I go up. I do the same thing I did last week. Crickets.
Oh,
nothing. Like, complete bomb.
How did that make you feel after feeling the alternative?
I just felt awful. And I just felt I literally didn't do comedy again for like 6 months.
Wow.
I was so depressed about it. And then somebody asked me to open up for Franken and Davis at Boston University, and I decided to do it, and I think I got a standing ovation doing that, and they said, okay, maybe I should continue doing it. But I realized about comedy why I didn't want to do it anymore so much is I liked being I didn't feel like I was in control. I felt other people were in control, and it was a different time.
Yeah,
because now I think comedians are more in control. And
sure, between all the avenues that they have via podcasts or YouTube videos or the content that they put out themselves, yeah, they are. They are in control of their own material. But back in that time, it was just you're trying to get on the Tonight Show. You're trying to get someone to discover you. You're trying to get someone like you're waiting for a gatekeeper to come to you and say you're famous now.
The goal, I mean, as a comic back then, was just if you could do the Tonight Show, it would be that. You know, I interviewed Henry Bushkin, who was the manager lawyer for Carson, and you know, that was the whole thing. It's just you just wanted to do that. But it's a different time now. The goals of comedians have changed. And I think
Somebody just wants to get featured on a BuzzFeed, some bullshit like the top 10 comics to watch in the northeast part of Orange County. Like somebody just wants that type of accolade to go, all right, I'm doing – like the opportunities for mini validations, I think, are much greater.
Well, I think that's true. And like, and I loved – and so I started running comedy clubs because I love that world. And I had like, God knows, 50 different, you know, one-nighters and comedy clubs in New England. Was doing really well, and then I moved to New York and opened a comedy club in Greenwich Village, where right around the corner from the Comedy Cellar, called the Boston Comedy Club, which was there for like 20 years until I moved out here. And
who came through that Boston Comedy Club?
Oh my God! This is the thing. Like I always loved young comics who weren't given a shot. And people like Chappelle and Jay Moore and Brewer and Daryl Hammond and, you know, all these people who...
And you would find them, or they would just hear about the club and then you'd...
I would find them because I was out in the clubs all the time. And something Neil Brennan said to me, which is fascinating, he said that in his entire career, there isn't anything in his career that's happened...
Podcast, yeah.
That hasn't happened from him hanging around the comedy club.
We're just talking about that on the way over here. Yeah. I actually brought, when he did our podcast, I brought that up because I loved him making that point on the Industry Standard with Barry Katz. But that
available on iTunes.
But it's so true, and I think that is. I mean, that happened for Neil at like what 10 or so years ago when he started, and I feel like that's still just as.
Well,
sure,
it's something that I like to tell comics is when they're getting started up in Hollywood, just be around the scene, hang out, see what it is, see what the experts are doing, and just have people start associating you with being a comedian. Like if you're seen in a comedy club, they go, oh yeah, that guy he's always here. He must be a comic. Yeah.
And I don't, you know, and what's weird is I didn't always take that tack that Neil said because I always felt. Comedy clubs, and I still feel this way, but it's just how you navigate around it. Mm-hmm. Comedy clubs are cancer. I mean, everything about it is cancerous because every single person at that comedy club, this is the thing that it's the unspoken thing is that if you're a comic and you're walking to a comedy club and you're doing a set, no one wants you to do well. No one wants you to do better than them.
Mm-hmm.
They all want you to fail before they do so they can get there first. They're all going to walk up to you and say, hey, did you go on this audition for, you know, the Tidy Bowl guy? No, I didn't. Oh, man, it was a great audition. Big money, too.
Should have gone out for that.
You know, you should be so famous by now. It's unbelievable. What's up with that?
What are you doing? Oh, by the way, is that your drink? It is. You had one earlier, didn't you, too? Yeah, so you're drinking a lot. That's good. Yeah.
And people, and these comedians, they're like, as Whitney Cummings would say, they're emotional ninjas. They know how to fucking get to you. And so I used to always tell comedians, which apparently I'm wrong about, because Neil says you should always hang out. You should hang out if you have mental toughness. But
that's
if you don't
true.
Have mental toughness, get in and get the fuck out.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Because it'll just crush you like a bug, these rooms and where these people
are. Yeah, and you need to have your wits about you for the road that is about to you're about to travel on, that is the comedy world, because I feel like as you're saying, like it is crushing. I think even I don't know if it ever gets to a point to where it can't be crushing. I mean, even for the guys who are still doing theaters, I mean, there's got to be an element of just loneliness that still seeps in.
I can assure you, because I have been in, and I don't think it's wrong of me to tell this story. I worked with Dane Cook for 17 years.
Yep.
Okay, so
we're looking at the, every album of his that's gone platinum, double platinum. I mean,
it was an amazing, amazing run, and you know, a lot of people have a lot of like. you know, the trouble is like when you make it, you become polarizing and people will try to take you down.
Sure.
It doesn't make any difference who you are. I can guarantee you Louis C.K. has more enemies now than he ever had in his life, well, even though everybody thinks he's the most popular guy in the world right now, and he is.
Yeah,
and you just gain people who want to figure out a way to like say something or do something or whatever.
It's a weird thing that people somehow get in their heads that if they take down the top guy, if they insult him and take him down, that magically they'll be put into that spot. That's not the case.
It's like, not the case.
If Louis C.K. stopped doing comedy tomorrow, you're not going to be the guy that's just automatically put up there and is given an HBO special every year. You have to have the talent to back it up.
It's true.
In that work ethic.
So you got Dane before he – you got him when he was –
When he was just a young kid before he did anything.
Before he just let him in or his half hour.
Oh, before anything.
When he was wearing tank tops.
that was a very, very pinpointed decision to wear the tank top.
Yeah, really.
And that show, that was an interesting show. That was the first half hour special. And I made an agreement with Comedy Central that he would be allowed to do an hour. So I would have the hour to have to know that I had it.
How do you think to pull something like that? I mean, and that's obviously I've heard you make a lot of maneuvers like that. Which
you have heard that?
Yeah. Who doesn't want somebody in their corner that is thinking outside the box like that and is willing to make those types of arrangements?
There's that story, and maybe we could tell it briefly when they didn't let you in the Montreal Comedy Festival, and then you set up like your own Montreal Comedy Festival and like got all these comics development deals because of it. Yeah. What's that story briefly? Like,
what happened?
Briefly. How do you even say that word in this office right now?
True. But like,
that was an interesting time. What happened was is I'd gotten a lot of people into the festival. I had a great relationship with the guys at the festival.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one year, whatever it was, 93 or 94 or 95, I think it was 94 or 95, they didn't pick anybody I represented to go in. And that was unacceptable to me. I mean, I couldn't understand the possibility how they couldn't choose one person that I worked with. I brought them so many great people.
Yeah, and the Montreal Comedy Festival, for those who don't know, most prestigious comedy festival around. There's tons of industry there. People get deals there. People get discovered there. Big things happen there. So to be shut out as a manager, it's just you start panicking.
And so, I mean, I never – one of the things I should share with you guys, and I don't know, and I think this is something for anybody in any profession, I don't think you can panic. I don't think you can ever panic in terms of anything. You always have to – handle things in a way where you believe in your heart you can come up with a solution calmly and effectively, because you're never going to do well. As I say, you don't see Tom Brady in the huddle. Okay, guys, I'm a little anxious about this. I know there's 2 minutes left. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we'll win this, maybe we won't. Mm-hmm. It's like, you just got to go. You just got to go and make it happen. So what I figured is that
Peyton Manning doing that, though, by the way. Go Seahawks. Go
shut
Seahawks.
Your damn mouth. Seahawks. DeMarcus Ware is going to end your life.
No, but, the Peyton Manning, I'm glad you mentioned Peyton Manning. This is what's great about comedy, and this is what everybody should know. Things, rules are broken. You have a guy who's 15 years more experienced than one guy who gets the shit kicked out of him. And this young guy who's never been there before makes it happen. That's the metaphor for our business. If you want to make it, if you want to do anything, if you're testing for a show, everybody's got to direct the movie first, the first time. Everybody's got to do their hour the first time. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got to book a television show your first time. And you got to beat people who've been doing it multiple times.
Right.
And that's the way it is. So with Montreal, what happened was is that I called around to different comedy clubs, the Comedy Works, Jimbo, and asked him if I could have Friday, Saturday, and Sunday during the festival myself. He said no. Called a few other places. Then I called the late Ernie Butler, who had the Comedy Works, and he agreed without even knowing me. I sold him on the fact that I'm going to bring all these comedians down, and I'm going to have six different comedians on Friday, six different comedians on Saturday, six different comedians on Sunday. Now, back then, no email. Yeah. So then I did a plan where I put two ads in the Hollywood Reporter and Variety, which were big at the time, which aren't as necessarily big right now, $3,000 each. I didn't even have any money. I was just doing it. I put it together. And then I made, I talked to every comedian and enrolled them that I knew into flying themselves out there, putting themselves up. And
with the guarantee that
I would get industry in to see them before I even knew that I could. And so what I did was every day.
You just knew you'd find a way.
Yeah. So every day for a month out, I would spend from like midnight to 3 a.m. faxing people in the industry this invitation to get RSVPs. So we get out there. 225 industry people show up through the 3 days to watch people like Chappelle, Jim Brewer, Wanda Sykes, Tracy Morgan, Daryl Hammond.
All clients of yours.
And all clients.
All unknown at the time.
All unknown at the time.
Yeah.
What the fuck? I got 5 development deals, and no one else in Montreal got a development deal that year. And
what?
And the people from the powers that be in Montreal flew to L.A., and they had a talk with me, and I never did another one of those again. But
that's incredible. I mean, yeah. Is that that's a pretty known thing that's happened?
I mean, I don't know how known it is.
Well, I mean, but it just shows the type of guy you are. And Adam said earlier, like, you're a guy that now, as a manager, not only do you have an impression of you, but you have a catchphrase. Like you tell people, "Be undeniable, man." and that's a scenario where you were denied, and you said, "Fuck that! I have to find a way to succeed." And you busted your ass to get those clients in because you believed in them, and also they believed in you because you told them, like you said, you got to fly yourself out. You've got to put yourself up in a hotel on this gamble. But as you've told me in this office during our meetings, Barry Katz, you look at me and you say, "Bran, safest investment you'll ever make is when you invest in yourself." And
you have to.
Yeah, and you have to trust that you're going to be the one to do the work and have the talent to overcome those sorts of obstacles. And that's the confidence that you instill in my clients. I tell Adam all the time, every time I come out of this office, I feel like I'm going to break down a wall. I feel like I'm fired up.
Well, that's good. I like to see that wall.
Yeah.
It's more of a doggy door.
It's got a flap
everybody.
On it.
Good night, everybody. I'll be at Flappers in Burbank tonight through Sunday in the Jimmy John's Chuckle Hut.
Who names a club Flappers? Let them know what I'm talking
about. That's a whole other podcast. But wait, so that type of gusto you had for Dane, though, with the tank top. I mean, those types of decisions.
Yeah, like you, I always thought outside the box of how you do things. Like, for instance, like one of the specials that he did, Isolated Incident.
Shot at the Laugh Factory.
Yeah, shot at the Laugh Factory. And the concept was, which, you know, if you can do it, you always want to figure out a way to do something that's never been done before, or something that's in a unique way. You can't change what something is or, like, one of the things I always say, which probably might get me in trouble, is like 30 Rock, one of my favorite shows ever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But if you are a historian of television, you can understand that that's the Mary Tyler Moore show. I mean, Tina is Mary, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Alec Baldwin is Lou Grant.
Right.
And Tracy Morgan is Ted Knight. That's it. I mean, but the fact is, that doesn't take anything away from 30 Rock. It's original, unique, special, unbelievably well written.
Yep.
The performances are like, I could just watch it over and over again. Talk about holy shit moments. But there's a formula there. And so, you know, when you're doing a stand-up special, what are you going to do? It's like, look, you know, you watch The Underground with Dave Attell, and I was so happy about him doing that in Comedy Central again. This is a guy who I don't believe has done a comedy special in 8 years, maybe.
He hasn't done a series
for a long time. But this is what I want to talk about, which is important, besides, because I don't think it's important talking about the things I've done that's outside the box, because that's, I think, boring. This is more important for your audience. Comedy Central made a decision. We're going to give this guy his own show again, and we're going to give him another hour special. Now, he's probably closer to 50 than he is 40. Mm-hmm. Why are they giving him these things again? The reason why they're giving them to him again is because of the inevitable thing that all comics face that they don't want to address, is the fact that there are maybe 25, at best, if you stretch it, 50 comedians who you could actually say are doing something special. And I'd go closer to 25. Mm-hmm. So the reason why they don't give that underground to a young new person or whatever is because they don't have the content that somebody like Attell has. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why you'll always keep seeing the Chris Rocks over and over again and over and over again. And this is what I want to talk about with you guys, because this is really important, because it's almost a sad fact about our business. If you're a singer, okay, just bear with me with this.
No problem.
If you're a singer, you could be the greatest singer in the world in like Arcadia, Florida, and you may never be discovered in your life and never get a shot. Mm-hmm. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of brilliant, brilliant singers, musicians, songwriters, bands. They will never see the light of day. Only a select few will. If you're a comedian who's doing material that's a combination of George Carlin and Chris Rock, and you are performing in a restroom in Guam, you will fucking make it to the top, and people will find you and chase you like your ass is on fire. So every comedian listening, you have all the tools out there that I never had. Royce Clayton, a baseball player for 17 years who won a world championship with the Red Sox in 2007 and replaced Ozzie Smith in St. Louis.
Which, if you can't see, Barry just pointed to, I think, is the on-deck circle that is framed right behind his fucking beautiful head. that is
from the World Series.
From the World Series, from the 2007
that was the Red Sox.
Red Sox, on-deck. Your team.
Yeah, you can see the cleat marks there.
That's incredible. Do you know the individual cleat marks of the play?
I do not.
Would be a crazy fan.
I actually just stepped on that to make it look
So Clayton.
But the thing is, he said something that I think people have joked about, and Tracy Morgan has joked about. I said, how did you do it? How did you replace Ozzie Smith? He said, when I was a teenager, I said, I'm going to replace Ozzie Smith in St. Louis. Wow. He would say it to his mother. And he had this amazing story where he talked about this, where he said, you know, he went to Burbank, I think Burbank or somewhere. He's born in Burbank, but he went to high school somewhere around Los Angeles. And there was one player on the team, and a metaphor for everything we deal with in our business or any business. There was one guy who was better than him.
Yep.
Always better than him.
Right.
And he'd finish each game, and he'd finish the game and get some shorts on. He'd go up to the guy and say, hey, you want to go for a jog throughout the mountains? And the guy would say, fuck you, Clayton. I just hit two home runs. I'm not going to jog around the mountains, whatever. Sure. And every game, after every practice, he'd take another jog, ask the guy. The guy would never go. But he was the best player. They both get picked for the Junior Olympics to represent our country. Royce Clayton hits a walk-off home run to win the game. He rounds the bases. Everybody's celebrating. The guy takes him aside, hugs him, and says, hey, Clayton, I didn't know you had it in you. He's like, yeah, I had it in me. Listen, after this, I'm going to go for a jog. You want to go with me? He's like, what the fuck? You just hit the home run to win the game. It doesn't matter. I'm going. One person made the pros of those two, and one didn't. And that was Royce Clayton, because he worked harder than everybody else. And he said this thing that I'll never forget, which you probably heard before. Study greatness, imitate greatness, become great. So all of the people in the comedy business, you have all the greatest comedians out there to see. You can study how they did it, how they construct their jokes, how it goes, how they ring out the thing. And for those of you in comedy, what's all about is taking that premise like it's a wet washcloth. And every single joke you get out of it, you just one ring and the water comes out, and then just get another one and you get another one. And just when you think after like 10 versions of that joke, you can't get anything else out, you just get that one more drop out again. And it's all about your content that's going to get you where you want to go. And I looked at both of you guys, and I have a lot of respect for both of you guys. But if there was that famous truth serum in my veins, and I were going to be like an evaluator of the material, the content of the material, and does it stand up to George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Chris Rock, Bill Cosby, And even you guys with the serum in your veins would say, no, it doesn't. But you know what the greats have done, and you know what they, the kind of comedy they do. But sometimes what happens is when you get into a certain mode, you play into a certain kind of comedy. Like, just for instance, and I know these are difficult conversations, but I think
no, this is great. Yeah, I'm
like,
listening
for instance,
with intent,
like your comedy set, Brad, for The Underground. I just got the link. I saw it. And just to let you guys know, you fucking destroyed.
Well, thank you,
sir. It was unbelievable. The performance was great. The way you presented the comedy was great. The timing was like cast iron timing.
You look good.
You look good. The relationship with the audience was great. Everything was great. There was only one thing that could be your downfall.
Okay.
That the material was could be determined that it was lowest common denominator comedy. Not all of it.
Sure.
I'd say probably 50% of it.
Okay.
There were jokes in there that were jokes that were, they involved parts of the anatomy.
And certain, yeah, certain things below my waist that you apparently look in the mirror and identify with.
Yes. you know, and there were jokes about, you know, fucking somebody and, you know, as a little person and whatever. And so these are things that, even though they kill and get standing ovations in rooms, you're going to either make it with your lane or you're not. Now, the difference, I want to get to you in a second.
Yeah, we were hoping on the car right over we were both get Bearcats broken down.
So this is the thing.
There you go.
But the thing about you, Brad, where you have an advantage over other comedians is the fact that because you're a little person, there is no other little person in 100 years of comedy that has headlined comedy clubs and theaters. You're the only one.
Yeah.
So therefore, just like when Chris Rock did 10 minutes of Michael Jackson material in his third special,
sure,
he gets a get out of jail free card. It's Chris Rock. You know, it's like, hey, it was funny. It was amazing. Yeah. It was incredible. And yes, there's a lot of people who do Michael Jackson jokes, but you're Chris Rock.
Yeah,
you already have 3 hours of material.
You get a pass.
But for Brad, you have to choose what your lane is. And your lane, you've already chosen it. The lane you've chosen right now is as a guy who's an entertainer comedian.
Okay.
Not a – you haven't
– crushed by any means possible.
Yes, you haven't chosen the lane of I'm going to plant my feet, put the microphone in front of me in the stand, and I'm going to tell jokes that if people were blind, they would laugh at. Right now, your whole thing is the whole physical presentation. I'm a small man, and I'm going to show you that I'm larger than life. I'm going to move around the stage like no other person moves around the stage who's 6 feet tall. I'm going to dance on the stage like no other comedian you'll ever seen. I'm going to do things with an audience member that no one would ever think I could do.
Sure.
And that's the lane you've chosen, and it's working for you. The problem is, as you go on as a comedian, just like Jim Carrey as an actor doing Ace Ventura, as you alluded to, and then doing The Mask and doing Me, Myself, and Irene, when you get around to doing Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, it grosses $12 million, even though it's the greatest performance of your life. Because people don't want to see you do that anymore. They just want to see you do what they know you to do.
Right.
So people are coming to see you do that thing, the legend of what you do. Just like, and I don't, please don't take this as an insult because you're not this kind of comic, but just like they went to see Gallagher break the watermelon.
Sure.
They go to see you do the lap dance.
Right.
Just like when they go to see Craig Shoemaker, they go to see the Love Master.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you think, too, that there's, I mean, like, for where he's at in his career right now, though, that, that this is, like, I think the comic that you're alluding to of him, like, really talking about things with the material being something that blind people could laugh at, that, that there's potential for him to get to that. In, like, 10 years, he could be at a different point in his life where that's more appealing to him, where that's where right now this could be Because obviously the growth and progression of comics, that's why we keep doing it, to see like where we'll be in you know, 5 or 10 years.
Louis, what are we gonna do next?
You see an old tape of Louis, like
it's a completely different comic.
I mean, just
can you make an active decision to be like, I'm going to be this guy, or do you have to let it happen organically?
Watch Louis' Saturday Night Live opening.
Yeah, it was incredible.
And watch the Saturday Night Live opening. Wonderful opening, incredible. But another thing you want to look at, because there's three sides to every story, look at how Louis might feel about other comedians who were performing back then and the things that they were doing that he felt were not the right things to do, like laughing at your own jokes or telling dick jokes. And so when you look at certain things, what you realize is that you're a comic when you're going and you're working so hard like Louis worked. And again, the things I feel for Louis in my heart are just, I have such strong, wonderful feelings for him because, you know, I'll tell you a personal story, a really personal short story. When I, a lot of people know this who listen to my podcast, but when I was 26, I was married and my wife passed away. She was 23. And my first Christmas, I was, you know, I didn't want to be around anybody. I didn't want to. And that Christmas Eve, it might have been Christmas. I think it was Christmas. I'm sorry. It was Christmas. I had one of those answering machines. And back then you had the answering machines that just, you could hear what people, you know, people would call, would go to the answering machine. You could hear the voice of the person.
You're right. As they're recording it.
And he called me like every hour.
Wow.
Barry, get out of fucking bed. You're coming over my house. I'm inviting you over my house. You're coming over. Calling and calling and calling to finally I picked up around like 4 o'clock in the afternoon and I said, what's up, Louie? And he said, Barry, you're coming here. You're coming to our house. And it was snowing out and it was crazy. And I said, Louie, I just don't feel good. You're coming. If I have to go over there and get you, you're coming. I said, okay, I'll come over. And I went over there and his whole family had presents for me. They had a seat at the table for me. I didn't know anybody.
Wow.
And I'll never forget that. And, you know, he was always wonderful to me. And his success, it's so incredible to see. But also, if you listen to some of his interviews, when people are on their way up and they're working so hard like he was working, and then you see other people doing better than you, no matter how great you are, it's tough to take. Just to use the Ozzie Smith example in sports, for those of you who don't know the history and lineage of it, Ozzie Smith was an ambassador to baseball. He was like the golden child. He never, ever said a bad word about anything. Never, ever rocked the boat. Classy in every way. Royce Clayton came to St. Louis during his last year when he was supposed to ride off in the sunset. He wasn't ready to ride off in the sunset. And he made Royce Clayton's life miserable to where Royce Clayton was the enemy. And he built himself up and did whatever he could to, and it was a bad scene because even after all those years in baseball, he still, it got to him and he did it. And comedians are the same way. It doesn't matter.
As great as you become.
As great as you become, there's always going to be something that's going to disappoint you or upset you, and you might say something that might be damaging or hurtful to people. And so what I was alluding to before, tying it all together, we were talking about comedians and if they, how they feel or get upset.
Getting lonely, yeah.
I was in Toronto. It was Dane's first date ever on a tour, okay? 21,500 people sold out.
Holy
Toronto.
Crap. Air Canada Center. Yeah,
I can't even imagine doing.
It was the first show ever. He says, I want to meet you. Can I meet you down in the dressing room at 4 o'clock? I said, sure. I get to the dressing room. And his head is in his hands, you know. He's just like, I'm like, what's up, man? He's like, I just don't want to do this show. I'm not feeling it. Now, keep in mind that a lot of times that what happens in a comedian's life is the greatest times of your life are when you experience some of the most difficult things that ever happened to you. Now, for him, he lost his mom,
right.
He lost his dad, and his brother was in the process of fucking him over, so there were a lot of variables, and the comedians were turning against him.
This was this show,
and this was his first show ever in an arena. And I just told him, I said, "Look, you know, this is a defining moment for you. It's a defining moment in your career. You're here to prove that your comedy works all over the world, and this is your first date, and you're going to go out there and you're going to kill him, and you're going to feel good afterwards. And he did an amazing show, and it was, you know, those are the kind of things that, you know, when I look at my my life, there are certain moments that we all point to that are fascinating. Like when I went to Boston Garden, you know, when we did the pitch for Chris Albrecht at HBO for the HBO special and the Tourgasm series, you know, the pitch was just, let's do it in an arena. He never worked in a place that was more than 500 seats in Boston, ever.
Kid. And now he wants to do the Garden.
And now he wanted to do the Garden. And
yeah, how do you pitch that without when you have no prior experience of doing shows of that magnitude?
Because both of you guys are great salespeople because you're selling your comedy. Yeah. And on my side, I like to sell the artist and the belief that we're going to do something different that's never been done before. And Chris Albrecht, to his credit, he hadn't bought anything from me in 10 years because he was mad at me because of something that happened with Dave Chappelle. And he'll tell that story on the podcast if you listen to it. But okay. He was really not doing anything with that. Couldn't get him to buy anything.
But as a manager, you can't say, all right, well, 10 years went by.
No, I would always keep going in and trying. But, you know, and he would never say that it was because of anything. And so what's fascinating about the Boston Garden show, the HBO special, which was actually the first arena ever. I'm sorry, Toronto wasn't. He had this thing on MySpace where he had like 2.5 million friends or fans or however you describe
it. He revolutionized comedy that way, Dane did.
And that concert, the first show on sale, we didn't know there was going to be a second show. We had a goal for a second show. And he put it on a pre-sale, where there was nobody allowed to get any tickets. There was no ad in any newspaper. There was no Facebook. There was nothing. There was no radio, nothing. He had his computer. We set up the link on Ticketmaster for a pre-sale, and he made a little bulletin, and he pressed a button on his computer. And as I looked to the heavens, in 2.5 days, 19,000 seats were sold out, and we rolled it over to another pre-sale for the second show, which sold out in less than a week. And he'd sold 39 or 38,000 tickets for one night with the press of a button. Not one person from the general public who wanted to buy, just who didn't have his code or wasn't on MySpace, got to go to that show.
That's incredible.
And
wow.
That's when you're sitting in that arena and walking around that arena in Boston Garden where you watch the Celtics, you know, win championships, and you realize 3 or 5 miles down the road you were in Kenmore Square watching Stephen Wright, or you were in your comedy club at Play It Again Sam's in a smoky basement doing the reverb for some comedian doing a parody of John Cougar Mellencamp. It lets you know how far you can come and how far you can go. And that's the thing, like when I talk about comedy and I talk about comedians, if you can figure out how to do the right kind of comedy, you can... I don't think you can fail unless you're an alcoholic or you're a drug addict or you're a asshole or you're a drama queen or king. I don't think you can fail. I really don't. And you can succeed not doing the right kind of comedy too. And I don't want to go into the examples of that, but there's a lot of people who got gigs on television or those things. They booked their first acting job and then they started doing comedy. Or there's a lot of guys who've been done different television shows. They're out doing comedy tours now. There's people who do radio or doing comedy now. And when you go to see them, within 5 minutes, you know that the material isn't the right. I want to talk about somebody who I'm not even really that close with for some reason. I don't know why, but when I go to see Jim Jeffries, okay, I feel like my stomach feels like I felt when I watched Basic Instinct. Okay, I am uncomfortable. I am like really, really. If I have a girl with me, I like, I don't even know what to say. But I will tell you this: I know I'm watching greatness.
Yeah, yeah.
I know I'm watching something that reminds me of what I used to see when Bill Hicks was working my club in the Village. I know I'm watching somebody do something that's I don't think anybody does. Now, I'm not saying that I, you know, I feel great inside after I watch it. The thing I feel great about is the fact that I see somebody doing something that's extraordinary, that you can't watch that and as a relevant comedian and say, yeah, that guy's a hack.
Right.
No.
It's impossible. The material is, I saw him and on a night when I saw you destroy the place, by the way. That was an incredible set you had that night.
Was it the Hollywood Improv that night with me, Jim, and Jay Moore?
Yes.
Cool. Thank you.
Show. That show would probably cost you like $200. But I saw the guy do a bit on, I can't pronounce the name, on the guy that with no legs.
Oh, Oscar Pistorius.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember the bit. Yeah.
The guy, I mean, the guy's acting out. Like, it's like a 12-minute bit. He's acting out a murder and crawling across the floor and dragging himself. It just, the guy is acting out a murder in his comedy routine. Now, I'm not suggesting this for the comedians that are listening. I'm just saying that.
He's that good.
He's chosen to take a lane that is risky, that is unique, that is certainly not for everybody. I'm telling you right now, I can't. I mean, it the some of the stuff like he's talking about, like when you're, I can't even say this, but when you're standing up and your girl is on her knees and you're grabbing her hair and you're just about to do that thing that guys do.
You're describing the night of my bar mitzvah party.
Yeah.
It was just.
And then he says, you know what the guy's really saying when he's grabbing your hair and he's just about to do that, he's like saying, like, I hate you, you fucking, and he says the C word.
Mm.
And, you know, you're sitting there with a woman who you hope to have that happen to you later at night. And she looks at you, do you feel that way when you do that? So it's like, but the fact is, even though I know I'm never going to see that girl again that I'm with, I'm so respectful of Jim. When I see, Dave Chappelle do the routine about the crack baby in Compton walking down the street and selling drugs or whatever.
Hey, baby!
Yeah, even though, you see, when Jim Jeffries is doing that routine, he's acting out the murder.
Right.
What's crazy about what he's acting out is you can actually feel like this could actually have happened.
Sure.
When Chappelle is describing the 3 or 4 year old with the diaper, you know there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that this could actually happen, but you actually feel like it could happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he takes reality, he just twists it slightly, and he brings you something that you can't get anywhere else.
That's a storytelling ability that's just you can't teach, because there's something about him when he talks and in his face and his voice that you want to believe what he's saying, and then you end up believing it after you listen to it for a few minutes.
Yeah, and so when I was talking about your act, Brad, you're in a situation where, whether you like to admit it or not, when you make it big, and you're going to make it huge, and I'm never wrong about that. I've never been wrong about that stuff.
I love that.
You're going to be a huge, huge act, but you have to understand that the mainstream comedians, no matter how nice you are all going to be shitting on you because you're doing an act that's bigger than life, and they see it as a show. They see it as a show. You can just see, and I'm not saying he says this, but I'm just thinking to myself, you can just see insert comedian here as you're doing your act at the April Foolishness and back on. Oh, great. Fantastic. Right. I got to follow the dancing fucking midget.
Sure. Well, I think Bill Burr said it during the K-Rock April Foolishness.
Yeah.
I think he was trying to work out a Hitler bit, and people were half on board with it. And he goes, really? I mean, fuck it. You can watch a dancing midget? I can't talk about Hitler for 2 minutes?
Yeah. So so there you go. So and it's like Bill Burr is another example of a guy. Bill, and again, I wish you were sitting here.
Mm-hmm.
to show you how crazy our world is now, where Bill, what's happening with Bill now would never have happened 20 years ago. You're talking about a guy, just so your audience knows, this is what's so amazing about Bill, another guy I have incredible respect for.
Yeah, one of the best working today, for sure.
He started off, he booked his first acting job he ever went out for, called Townies with Molly Ringwald. It was a Carsey Werner show.
Holy crap.
Okay, first job he ever went out for. Then he didn't book another acting job for over a decade. Okay? Was working the clubs, never was really drawing crowds, nothing. Even when he was gaining a following, still not selling out every show at comedy clubs. Goes on an Opie and Anthony show.
Traveling Virus Tour. Okay? I remember this.
Every comic's getting their ass handed to him, getting booed off the stage. He's getting his ass handed to him. But miraculously, some person with a cell phone that records or a camera just records him getting the shit kicked out of him. But he starts coming back and fighting back and saying, you know, stuff like, you guys are booing me.
Yeah,
this you fucking bow down to some fucking statue of an inanimate object that isn't
it's
a real
Philadelphia.
Person?
And he's like, really, you're biggest hero is your biggest hero, Rocky, is completely fictional.
Yeah,
nice job.
And then
asshole.
He starts killing in the last 5 minutes. He's crushing, and this is recorded on the shitty audio and video recording.
Go on YouTube and look it up.
It goes on YouTube, and I know if Bill were here, he knows that he's where he is right now because of extraordinary hard work. But he's also where he is right now because one random fan with a camera recorded his brilliance, and the whole world could see it. George Carlin used to say this thing. He used to say, I'm doing it all wrong. I'm going from venue to venue, spreading my word to like 1,500 people in every city, each city I go to. Then I wrote my first book. 1,000,000 people read it. And that's what happened with Bill. It's like we all knew how brilliant Bill was, but the world didn't know until this random person took this thing and put it up
there. Now, why was it that clip and not like just a great clip of him just killing?
Because he had done a Showtime special. He had done, I think, Shaq's comedy all-star, like one of those sort of comedy shows.
I'm curious how.
But I think, in my opinion, the reason being with anything is like, America loves the underdog.
Yeah.
Everybody loves the underdog. That's why, Brad, in your world, you're imbombable. When's the last time
I'm a snowman?
When's the last I'll give you an example. I should write this down in an envelope. I already know the answer. Mm-hmm. When's the last time you ate it? I mean ate it. You bombed. How long ago?
It was the Super Bowl when the Colts were playing the Saints. I was in Philadelphia at Helium, and it was a huge snowstorm. 20 people came out to my show, and they were miserable, and I was miserable because there were only 20 people in the audience, and I ate shit that night.
Now, how long ago was that?
That was, let's see, that Super Bowl is 4 years ago? 3-4 years ago?
You ate shit, like you didn't get laughs?
No,
none. And it took you out of it? You didn't give your best?
Yeah, it was...
How many shows have you done since then? Approximately. Geez. Just tell the audience.
Well, yeah, 52 weeks, 45, 7. Over 1,500 shows.
Okay.
Over 2,000 shows.
All right. So Brad Williams in his comedy is... Mm-hmm. This is, again, using the brain surgeon-esque example here. You have failed one time in 1,500 shows.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's insanity. That's like that's how every comedian hopes. I always tell to any comedian, listen, if you want, they always say, how do I get to the next level? How do I get to the next level? I always say, whatever your home club is, if you kill 10 times in a row where every audience member says you were the best, the bar back, the waitresses, the bartender, the manager, the comedians who hate you.
Yeah.
If you do it 10 times in a row, get a helmet because you're going to another level if you can do that. Mm-hmm. There's no stopping you if you can do that. Because if you can beat those odds in your home club, you can do it at the away team.
Yeah, Delia just hit that, I'd say, right about probably about a 2 years ago, maybe.
Probably. Yeah, and I think Chris is, you know, he's an interesting case, Chris, because he was, for those of you who don't know, he grew up in the business. His father is a director, and he was around show business a lot. And Chris is an interesting case because, you know, everybody has their own winning formula. And he has a very unique winning formula, not just in his comedy, but in how he dresses every day at the comedy club. He's just like a T-shirt, an old jean guy, and it's almost like he's been transported from another time and era here. But I think his comedy, you know, when you do it over and over again, and you work hard enough, and you repeat something over and over again, you're going to become at a point where it's like you're at another level. And I think Chris is getting to another level. And I think also, though, but he would agree, is he at Carlin's level? Is 10 minutes of his at Carlin's level or Rock's level or, you know, or Chappelle's level? And even he, if he were sitting here, would say, no, it's not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the goal. The goal is to figure out a way to do something on stage where people talk about you. What I love about this podcast right now, and this is another thing you learn about comedy, if you want to get someplace in comedy, like I'll always ask a comedian, tell me three comedians who are working around here that aren't really household names that you like. And they'll mention three names. And then I'll just stand there and they'll say, well, do you have any advice for me? And I'll say, yeah, become one of those fucking three names that people are talking about. Become Gerard Carmichael.
Right.
Become the young kid who comes to town and is nice to everybody and goes on stage and does material that isn't derivative and is unique and special, and somebody who can actually go into an audition and act and book an acting job. You know, that's what it's all about.
I'd love to hear Brad's kind of just take on what you told him about, like, being in a place now where it is a very comic/entertainer, and how or if he should stay in that lane, or if you think, like, you enjoy, like, if you for yourself want to be in, like, 10 years from now having, like, less of entertaining and more leaning on that mic stand and talking about some...
Well, and it's funny because I've had this conversation with Barry before.
And not so concerned with, like, the big laughs, which I know is... I mean, I think we all are. You and I both at this point, like, that is... You want to put on the best show possible.
Sure.
And since we are trying to still climb to a point to where we have, you know, maybe the respect from not only our fans but our peers, but at the same time, maybe we're losing something by being so concerned with the quality of the show.
Well, and I wanted to test this. Barry had told me this. Barry, you told me this in this office before. Like, this, you talked about your Mount Rushmore comedy, and would George Carlin do a lap dance in his act? Would Chris Rock do a lap dance? And I thought about it, and I needed to know, was I a good comedian, or was I just an okay comedian? And then when I do that lap dance in the end, that's when I get everyone to stand up and applaud. So I took it out. I haven't been doing the lap dance for the last 3 months on the road. And the fact that I remember it was the first weekend I did it was in at the Arlington Draft House, which Adam, you and I have both played. Great club. And they had come there, and some guy even yelled out 5 minutes into my set, we're going to see the lap dance. Yeah. And I knew, nope, not tonight. Not going to do it. And I did my act. I did an hour. I said thank you. Put the mic back in the stand. Standing ovation. And people still came up to me afterward and said, dude, we've seen a bunch of comics here. This is the best show we've seen. I thought, okay, I think I've got something here.
How'd that make you feel?
Better than any standing ovation I've ever gotten with the lap dance.
And you know what's incredible about what Brad said? If you're a comic, you know, every comic out there has a routine normally that they feel is their closer. Maybe unless you're Kirk Fox and you have, you know, you just have all different bits that you feel like you could close in everywhere, and you're going in a different style and direction, which is incredible. But every comic has a bit that they feel, hey, this is the thing I'm going to close on. You know, this is when Kevin Meaney was touring, it was We Are the World. He used to do all the, you know.
Pablo Francisco for so long had the little tortilla boy.
Yeah.
That was the closer.
Right.
And so for Brad, that closing bit and a lap dance, that's like his life's blood. That's like mm-hmm. his firstborn child. Yeah,
it is.
So for him to go on and take that safety net out of his act, that's one of the riskiest things the comedian could ever do. Sure. It's like almost like a guitar comic who has this big closure with the guitar, says, you know, I'm not going to do the guitar this particular thing.
Yep. And so, Nick Thune's been doing that recently and having great sets.
Yeah.
And it's been so fun to watch Nick put down the guitar and still going on stage and like, yeah, you're just a talented guy, Nick. You don't necessarily need the guitar. It certainly is a fun thing that you do, but you don't need it. You're great.
And what is the balance though between like, because I feel like taking out a big, like, whether, you know, there's some comics that end their acts on, whether it's a lap dance or musical cues, and they'll do a big, like, miming, a big driving to thing and pretending, you know, that there's different songs and a medley of a compilation of songs that they're doing different act outs each to each, you know, track. And then people that just close on strong bits. Like before I started headlining, I thought I was going to have to, you know, I do music. I even do like, I have this background with puppetry and stuff. And I was like, maybe I'll do some of that in my, cause I thought before I did it, I was like, oh, I need to have some sort of big, this is a show. I need to have some sort of, also the performer in me was like, I need to close on something memorable. And then I hosted for Greg Giraldo, who was, you know, one of my favorites, rest in peace, at the Irvine Improv. And I saw him every night close on a different closer. And I was just like, holy shit. And up until that point, the material had been so great and his crowd work. And it was just like he ended on that and said goodnight. And I was, you know, I'd seen other people do that. But for whatever reason, like the way maybe him switching up the closer, but just ending on a strong piece of material and then leaving people walking out going, you know, remembering a lot of people just walk out sometimes with that last thing that happens being what they take the whole show from. So maybe in a way that lap dance was like erasing a lot of great material you know, you could have had. But I walked out being like, God, that was incredible. And I remembered more of his material because of that last bit. So, I mean, I guess at what point do you need to – I mean, it's Brad said he's made an active choice to cut the
– And I think it's really incredible what he did. Now, I know what's going to – I mean, what's going to happen in your career, it doesn't matter, whatever it is. You're going to have people that are always going to try to take you down, Brad. That's the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
So I didn't say that to you to stop you from being a great entertainer because the thing is that I know as you grow, you're going to have – like when Dane toured – the amazing thing about him was a third of his act was really smart. The atheist bit was an incredible bit, like a 12-minute bit, incredible. Yeah. And then there was a third that was just silly stuff. You know, have you ever gotten so drunk that you, you know, got in the cab and you thought the fair was the time?
Mm-hmm.
And then there was other bits that were just so blue, like he did a 30-minute bit about, you know.
Cash you off the penis.
Yeah. I mean, so it's like, and that's was his choice of how he did it. And you're because you are a little person, you have a different choice than most comics have because you're the only one.
Right.
So you can do anything you want that makes you happy and soar. Because, you know, and it doesn't matter if you're doing the greatest material in the world or not or whatever, there's always going to be people that have an opinion, but the people love you. And that's all that matters. And for now, as long as they keep coming, the whole thing is about following. And I know people talk about this all the time, but it's like if you're a comic, you know, back then, you know, in the beginning, your goal was to, you know, to get the Tonight Show or do something like that. Now your goal is to have people follow you, not just follow you on Twitter, but follow you on Facebook. When you're in the comedy clubs, follow you to the comedy club. From the comedy club, follow you to the theaters. From the theaters, follow you
to the TV shows.
From the TV shows to the podcast. From the podcast to the movies. It's all about your audience, bring your audience where and having the comfort that they want to go wherever you want to go. And I think we should talk about your act for a second.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let me just tell you, too, at a taping of Whitney, the TV show with Whitney and Chris, you told me, again, you said that I'm going to be a star, that you're never wrong. You said you've got the looks, the charm, the chops, and then you said stay away from I think pussy and booze and drugs. And I said, I can try.
Two out of three, I bet.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever been to with a little person?
What's that?
Have you ever slept with a little person?
No, but I've seen Brad almost naked, and I feel like that's like close enough. Okay. Like, yeah, yeah. Great ass.
Through osmosis.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You forgot something I did tell you, though, that why I believe that you're going to do really, really well. Because you have the ability to book significant acting jobs.
Well,
the $200 million movie.
Did you forget that?
Yeah. I mean, but what I remember, you said, though, because you'd asked me, this was, I think, before I got in the heat, and you said about being undeniable, because I'd been through two solid pilot seasons of getting, not testing, but getting a lot of callbacks and then just not going further. And it happened again this pilot season. And for the first point, to where my manager and agent were starting to think if there were other things that I could be doing, and they're maybe thinking I was over preparing, like trying to come up with a reason why it didn't happen, why I didn't book a show this season. And I would comfort them by telling them I'm great in the room. I don't over prepare when I coach with anybody. A lot of it is for the I'm already coming in with my own preparations, and a lot of it is getting to have some doing it out loud with somebody else, and then people that know me and know my strengths and weaknesses to able to throw things at me that I can take to make adjustments or not make adjustments. But then I've gotten to a point where I really do well at throwing all that away when I get in the room and just try to be as present as possible. But you get to the point where you're starting to break it down. Like, are you being too funny at the beginning? Are you trying to get them to like you too much at the beginning? Like, there's always things you try to dissect when you're not having a booking. And after the heat, there was a part of me that was like, all right, at least I'm going to get into more rooms and whatever. I know this isn't going to mean I'm going to start booking every show and Sandler's not going to throw me in every movie now. It doesn't work like that. But
did you get in more rooms?
Yeah. And I mean, for stand up, I started headlining every weekend for the last year. And a lot of generals and a lot of things. But there was no immediate, this last pilot season came and went, and there was no, nothing I, got attached to. And for me, I know how this business works, and I know that, like, I was laying the ground level.
Let's break that down.
Yeah. But I remember you saying that at the Whitney taping, like, why aren't you, at one point, because I expressed my frustrations, and you said, why aren't you being undeniable?
I said, why aren't you being undeniable? But I did say, I'll reiterate, yeah, that you did have the skill set to book significant acting jobs, yeah, and I felt that from you.
Thank you.
But let's go back.
You want to go to my act or my acting?
Let's just talk about the acting here for a second.
By the way, this couch is very conducive for therapeutic purposes.
Like, yeah, no kidding, right?
It's very, we're both set up. I haven't gotten, maybe we should talk about how my dad cheated on my mom first before we get into all this.
We're
going
to get to that in a second.
Yeah, no.
This couch is like, it's very large.
It's great.
This is an interesting thing I'm going to ask you, okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you said 4 years. Okay.
Yeah.
In 4 years, tell me approximately how many auditions you've had in 4 years.
Oh, Jesus.
Right. If you had to guess.
I mean, I thought about this about a week ago, and overwhelming.
Just tell me the number.
Jesus, I mean.
You're over 100?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Look at
I'd
him.
Say close to 40. I mean, I don't want to say 500 seems too many. So, but I'd say up to like over 300 probably. All
right. Let's just say 400.
Okay.
Okay. Now, Brad's saying to himself, 400, I get an audition once every 400 days. That's because there's 7 roles available for you a year.
Exactly.
So you're going out for it. It's like,
and 6 of them go to Dinklage. Yeah. That asshole.
And the other one is because you can't throw a gold coin at a leprechaun's ass properly.
It happens. So 400 auditions.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell your audience how many auditions you booked?
Out of those 400?
Uh-huh.
6?
6.
Mm-hmm.
6 out of 400. Okay, so you're the antithesis as an actor, as Brad is as a comedian.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about comedians and certain skill sets in the world. You think that because you're on stage and you're writing, producing, acting, directing, and starring in your own show every night to a different audience and killing,
mm-hmm,
killing 1,499 times out of 1,500,
right.
Then naturally I can go into a room with an intern with a camera holding it and saying, hey, could you slate, please?
Yeah.
And then the person reading the sides to you like a functionally autistic person would read the sides. And you'd think, hey, I can beat this. I can deal with a heckler. I can do whatever. But it's a different muscle. It's very similar. It's very similar to roasting. People think, oh, I'm watching this guy roasting. This must be easy. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why Jeff Ross has done 17 roasts and they don't mix it up a little bit.
Right.
It's because there's not a lot of people who can do it and do it well.
He's
it's just a very tough, tough situation. And it's the same with stand-up comedians, why there's so few of them that you can point to that are extraordinary. It's very hard to do. So for you in acting, you have to analyze this. So we're going to look at this for a second.
Yeah.
I want you to tell your audience honestly.
Yeah.
Why have you gone, and I'm going to be really cruel here for a second, because I'll do what you would do in a roasting sense.
Okay.
Okay. Why in the last three pilot seasons have you booked as many jobs as a dead guy? A fucking cadaver could walk into every audition and book as many jobs as you booked. Why?
Wow.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schleichinger. I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.